Hello, and welcome to Science World. Today we'll hear about two new studies concerning giant plant-eating dinosaurs that roamed the Earth between 76 and 150 million years ago. Carol Pearson tells us about a new study that looked at people around the world to see if they followed their doctor's advice following a heart attack, and four mysterious and powerful radio bursts that traveled halfway across the universe were detected by a team of astronomers. We'll talk with one of the scientists behind the discovery. This and more are coming up for you on VOA Science, Health and Technology magazine, Science World. Dinosaurs never fail to fascinate. Plant-eating giants that roamed the Earth between 76 and 150 million years ago are the subject of two studies released on Wednesday. One of those studies announces the discovery of a remarkable new species. And as Roseanne Skirbel reports, the second study takes a closer look at dinosaur teeth, which, like modern-day shark's teeth, were replaced whenever they fell out.
Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument is the last great largely unexplored dinosaur boneyard in the United States. In recent years, paleontologists working in the rugged high desert of southern Utah have unearthed some 20 species. Their latest find is Nasutoceratops, which means big-nosed horn face. It appears to be a new branch of the horned dinosaur family tree related to the well-known Triceratops. Scott Sampson led the project as chief curator with the Natural History Museum at the University of Utah. He says Nasutoceratops lived 76 million years ago.
He and or she is unique in having this tiny little horn over the nose and then these big, long horns over the eyes, which is very different from the closest relatives within that group of horned dinosaurs.
The four-legged herbivore stood about 5 meters from head to tail and weighed about 2.5 tons. Sampson says the discovery includes a nearly complete skull, 1.5 meters long, and pieces of two or three other skulls.
With that mostly complete skull, there is a neck and part of the back, that is the vertebrae and the backbone. We also have forelimb, shoulder and forelimb, all the way down to the foot on that one animal. So we're missing the back end of Nasutoceratops right now.
Nasutoceratops will be on permanent display at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The discovery was announced in the British scientific journal Proceedings of the Royal Society B. The current issue of the journal PLOS One features the largest terrestrial herbivores known, the long-neck, long-tail, big-body sauropod. Lead author Michael Demick, a paleontologist at Stony Brook University, and colleagues studied Diplodocus and Camarasaurus, two distinctly related sauropods of similar giant size but different body types. Diplodocus had low-slung shoulders, a horse-shaped skull, a tremendously elongated neck, and a whip-like tail. Camarasaurus had a shorter neck and thicker tail, larger teeth, and a broader skull.
Our starting question was, how did these animals live for so long side by side in the same ecosystem?
Demick figured that diet played a role. So assuming the role of paleodentist, he and his team removed teeth encased in skulls of the two animals to look for clues.
We looked at their tooth shapes, their tooth sizes, and their tooth formation and replacement rates, and we found that those things were very different in these two animals.
In the late Jurassic period, some 150 million years ago, Diplodocus and Camarasaurus fed on ferns and tough green vegetation like conifers, which could wear teeth down quickly. But sauropod teeth grew rapidly. When one tooth fell out, another was already lined up to replace it. Demick says the study revealed just how fast that happened.
Diplodocus was an extreme case, so it would have had a new tooth in each tooth socket about every month. Camarasaurus, a little bit slower, about one tooth every 2 months. Now, because Camarasaurus's teeth are so much bigger and broader, though, than Diplodocus's were, it actually was producing and going through a lot more material faster.
Demick says feeding habits were a factor in the survival of these two giants in the same ecosystem. He says Camarasaurus took a quality over quantity approach to its diet, while Diplodocus grazed with its head on the ground, eating as much as fast as it could. Studies like his, Demick says, bring the daily life of dinosaurs alive for people today. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
After someone has a heart attack or stroke, doctors usually recommend changes in lifestyle, like losing weight, exercising, or stopping smoking. A new study looked at people around the world to see if they followed their doctor's advice. Carol Pearson has the results.
We hear the message about how to live a healthy lifestyle so much that it's hard to imagine that there's anyone who hasn't heard it. Dr. Patrice Devine-Nickens is at the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, which is part of the National Institutes of Health.
Heart disease is preventable. Healthy lifestyles can reduce risks.
Dr. Devine-Nickens says there are three key elements to living a healthy life.
Don't smoke, maintain a healthy weight, exercise.
Ignoring even one of these increases the risk for cardiovascular disease, which includes heart attack and stroke, the number one killer around the world. So Canadian researcher Kuhn Teo at Ontario's Hamilton General Hospital wanted to see if people changed their lifestyle after one of these events. He followed patients in high, middle, and low-income countries.
People who had heart disease or stroke, about a fifth of them still continue to smoke. Only a third of people had regular physical activities. Just about two-fifths of them ate what we determine as a healthy diet.
And it didn't seem to matter where they lived.
Low-income countries had the worst diet. But if you look at the people from the high-income countries, they did not do that much better.
Only about 4% of the patients who participated in the study followed the recommendations.
All countries need to look at this finding to try to improve or close the gap about healthy living, particularly in people who had already had a stroke or a heart attack.
National and international efforts to get people to monitor their blood pressure and reduce salt consumption are gaining momentum. Both reduce the risk for heart attack or stroke. In the U.S., Janet Wright of the Million Hearts Campaign gives this advice.
Make one small change toward health and do it daily. It could be adding a fruit or a vegetable. It could be building your way up to 150 minutes of exercise each week.
The Cleveland Clinic has a program for its employees that has helped them lead healthier lives. Here's the clinic's Dr. Michael Roizen.
The key is to start. Buy a pedometer, record it daily, and try and walk till you get 10,000 steps, gradually increase it.
And if you take medication for high blood pressure, take it as prescribed.
Every day of an uncontrolled blood pressure is damaging the heart, the kidneys, the eyes, and all of the blood vessels, putting an individual at high risk for heart attack and stroke.
These experts stress that the power to prevent heart attack or stroke is in your hands. Professor Teo's study was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
Time for this week's Science World Quick Quiz. Since we just heard about heart attacks, what is the medical term for heart attack? Is it A, pyrosis, B, cardiomyopathy, or C, myocardial infarction? Do you think you have the right answer? Stick around. The correct answer is coming up in just a little bit.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World.
Human-made sound in the world's oceans, such as ship noise or seismic testing, may interfere with marine animals' ability to use sound effectively for essential navigation and communication. But as Megan McGrath reports, researchers collecting audio recordings in the Antarctic Weddell Sea have discovered that a melting iceberg can be a massive source of natural sound, in this case, as loud as a magnitude 4 earthquake.
Listen closely to this sound. It could be a stringed instrument like a double bass or maybe some kind of truck on the highway, but it actually is an iceberg in the Antarctic Weddell Sea, grinding slowly against the seafloor.
The iceberg essentially is scraping along and more or less resonating kind of like a tuning fork.
Robert Giac of Oregon State University led a team of scientists monitoring a collection of underwater microphones around the Antarctic Peninsula, the northernmost part of the southern continent. They detected the sounds of an iceberg being born as it cracked off the ice of the mainland.
It's big. It's about 25 by 50 kilometers in dimension, length and width. So it's essentially a little floating island out there that's moving around in the Southern Ocean.
Over the course of its life, from its calving to its journey toward warmer seas to its eventual melting, the iceberg was never out of range of the team's microphones.
We saw from the beginning, the birth of the iceberg, to its actual eventual death, for lack of a better word.
Giac says this may be the first time anyone has listened to a single iceberg for its entire life. And what his team heard when the iceberg floated into the warmer Scotia Sea was astonishing.
As it begins to edge warmer water, it begins to melt, and it can melt catastrophically. The sound of this iceberg breaking apart was an incredibly loud sound, equivalent to several hundred supertankers in noise levels.
That's as loud as a small earthquake, Giac says, loud enough to resonate all the way up to the equator. The oceanographers wondered if this much noise could pose a problem for marine animals, which use sound to navigate, communicate, and find food. Bioacoustician Chris Clark of Cornell University studies the effect of underwater sound on ocean life.
Whales and fishes, as a matter of fact, and now even all the invertebrates, like the lobsters and the shrimp and crabs and things like that, are all paying attention to sound. So there's been this increasing awareness and concern about, oh, noise in the ocean. Is it good or is it bad? Are we indifferent? You know, what's going on?
Human-created sound in the ocean is on the rise, from increased shipping traffic, seismic testing, and military sonar. And researchers are demonstrating more and more that ocean life is being affected. The noise, Clark says, can make it impossible for animals to hear the things they need to hear in order to live.
We refer to it as acoustic bleaching. It's as though suddenly there's a big fog bank that just comes into where you're living, and suddenly you can't see very far, only in this case the fog bank is noise.
But Clark says that temporary natural sounds, like an iceberg cracking apart, though they may be incredibly loud, are probably not nearly as harmful to marine life as man-made sounds.
It's one thing to have evolved over, you know, 5 or 6 million years in a world that's dynamic with storms, with ice. The human-generated noise in the ocean is so chronically persistent, it's now a real concern, and it dwarfs collective noise generated by icebergs.
Still, researchers say this is a time of warming oceans. Climate change may lead to more polar ice breaking apart and shattering loud like earthquakes in the southern seas. Megan McGrath, VOA News, Washington.
Solar cells are still a relatively expensive investment for ordinary consumers of electric power. But a group of scientists at Harvard University is looking for cheaper organic solar cells that could be painted on rooftops and building facades. In their research, they are employing the help of thousands of volunteers from around the world. George Putich has more.
Most of today's solar cells are silicon-based, and their manufacture requires sophisticated machinery and expertise. An average home in the United States uses between 20 and 24 kilowatt hours of electricity every day, and it may cost up to $20,000 to buy and install solar panels that can produce that much energy. While economical in the long run, it is an expense many cannot afford. But a group of researchers in the Harvard Clean Energy Project is looking for cheaper carbon-based compounds that could substantially lower that price. Project head Alan Aspuru tells VOA via Skype that a carbon-based solar cell would have to be about 10% efficient to make an impact.
This basically means that 10% of the sunlight that hits the device is converted into energy. There's about 3 or 4 or maybe 5, a handful of molecules that we know about that already have this efficiency. And this has been just discovered in the last year or a couple of years.
Aspuru says today's most commonly used silicon-based solar cells also do not have a very high efficiency, just about 15%. More efficient solar cells do exist, but they are used mainly on satellites due to their high cost. But cheap carbon-based solar cells could cover large surfaces, compensating for their low efficiency. Researchers have already identified 2.3 million carbon-based compounds, out of which 35,000 could potentially have efficiency above 10%.
That doesn't necessarily mean that these 35,000 molecules, all of them will be above 10% efficient for the solar cell. That basically means they could potentially be, and more research has to be done on them.
Aspuru says further analysis of those compounds requires large computing power, which his group is getting from volunteers around the world who donate their computer's time to a virtual supercomputer project.
In my case, in partnership with an IBM project called the World Community Grid, tens, hundreds of thousands of people that are registered in the database of IBM are on and off computing for many projects, including ours.
Researchers hope that their findings will spur innovation and that based on this research, experimental laboratories around the world will be able to come up with new materials. 10%? Results so far are encouraging. The Clean Energy Project has already discovered a powerful organic semiconductor named DA2T. The second best semiconductor reported in scientific literature. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Okay, let's see if you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz. Today we wanted to know what the medical term for heart attack is. Is it A, pyrosis, B, cardiomyopathy, or C, myocardial infarction? Well, the answer isn't A, pyrosis. That's one of the medical terms for heartburn, a common ailment many of us may get after eating a heavy meal. And no, it's not B, cardiomyopathy. That's the medical term that refers to diseases of the heart muscle. So the correct answer is C, myocardial infarction. A myocardial infarction or heart attack takes place when the blood flow to a part of your heart has been blocked long enough to cause heart muscle to die or become damaged. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
An international team of astronomers recently detected four mysterious and very powerful radio bursts they think may have originated halfway across the universe. Led by Dan Thornton from Australia's Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization, as well as the University of Manchester in Britain, the team scanned the skies with an Australian radio telescope to search for pulsars, which are rotating neutron stars or remnants of stars that have exploded. They also wanted to investigate the mysterious radio pulses that were first detected back in 2007. While the team identified only four of the mystery radio pulses over a one-year period, Thornton said that they might find thousands more once their entire sky survey is complete in a few more years. At the moment, they're thinking that these mystery radio signals could be the result of some major cosmological event that took place billions of years ago. Dan Thornton joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about finding the mysterious and powerful radio signals, where they're coming from, and what may have been the cause behind their formation. What kind of radio emissions are we talking about, and why do they seem to be so mysterious?
What we've discovered is very, very narrow radio emissions, so very short-lived. They only last for a few milliseconds. The main thing interesting about them is that they appear to be coming from across the universe, so extremely far away. We get lots of these radio emissions, a bit like this, from our own galaxy, from pulsars, but these appear to be coming from way, way outside our galaxy, a million times further away.
I'm curious, how were you able to tell that it came from outside the galaxy rather than from within the galaxy?
We are using a radio telescope in Australia at Parkes. It's using a receiver that has a wide bandwidth, so we're observing at lots of different radio frequencies simultaneously. And when we see a pulse like this, the low frequencies arrive slightly later than the high frequencies. In one of the bursts, this time scale is typically about 1 second. And there are theoretical predictions, and we've actually observed this in pulsars, that say when radio waves travel through ionized material, the lower frequencies propagate slower than the high frequencies. And so by measuring that time delay, we can work out how much ionized material the pulse has traveled through. And with a very simple model of where the electrons are in the universe, we can figure out what distance that equates to. And if we do that, we find that they're coming from halfway to the Big Bang.
Just how far away do you think these signals are coming from?
Well, we think that astronomers use this concept of redshift, a redshift of 1, which equates to halfway to the Big Bang. So that's a travel time of about 7.5 billion years. So these things, whatever it was that caused them, they left that source and have been traveling through the universe for 7.5 billion years before reaching our telescope last year.
Did all the radio pulses that you've received come within a relatively short time of each other, or were they spaced out over a period of time?
They came over a period of approximately a year. We had 4 over a period of a year, but there's no reason to suggest that when they come should be related to one another. They came from different places on the sky. So we calculate a rate for how many of these we might expect per sky per day, and we find that there's 10,000 going off every day somewhere in the sky, randomly distributed. But because we only have such a small window on the sky with our telescope, it has a very small field of view that we have to look for a very long time before we actually see one. And so that's why it's taken us a year to find just 4.
When you're looking out into the cosmos, speaking of field of view, as a whole, you've got a wide field to consider. Were the pulses detected by accident as your team was just scanning the sky, or were you focused and studying one particular sector of the sky?
Our survey was designed partly to find these things and partly to find pulsars, because there was one possible case of this was published in 2007, and everyone was a little bit unsure whether this was real or whether it was some kind of radio interference. So part of our survey, we decided to look for these things. And our survey covers the whole sky, so we're slowly tiling the sky with our fields of view. It's going to take us a few years in total to complete that job. But as we do it, we're searching for these things. And we weren't sure we were going to find them. We weren't sure they were real or not, but we were looking for them.
You said that the findings pointed to some extreme events involving large amounts of mass or energy as the source of the radio bursts. Now,
yes.
What kind of extreme events are we talking about, and what leads you to believe this?
We think it's probably an extreme cataclysmic event, so something that destroys whatever it was that creates it, because we haven't seen them to repeat. We've looked back at the same patch of sky, and we haven't seen any repeat bursts at the same position. So this leads us to believe that they only happen once. So it's perhaps an explosive event, like a supernova, like a star coming to the end of its life and exploding, possibly, or associated with perhaps a giant burst from a magnetar. Now, this wouldn't be a cataclysmic event. This is something that can happen multiple times at the same source. But it's not really clear what one of these giant bursts is. It's current work going on in the astronomy community to try and figure out what these things actually are.
Have you heard anything from SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute? Do you think that this is something they may want to check out for themselves?
I don't think so. This is definitely nothing to do with alien civilizations. If you calculate the luminosity of these bursts, they're absolutely enormous. It's just not possible for that amount of energy to be harnessed in just 5 milliseconds. I mean, the energy output at source of these bursts is how much energy the sun gives out in total in 300,000 years. But this happens in just 5 milliseconds. And I can't imagine how anyone would be able to control that. And they also obey extremely well physical theoretical predictions for how natural electromagnetic phenomena can produce these kind of radio waves. As well as that, they obey extremely accurately the theoretical and observational laws of propagation that we've measured many, many times for the way these kind of radio waves propagate through the universe or through charged material.
That was Dan Thornton from Australia's Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization and the University of Manchester in Britain. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. We'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.